He is the founder, owner, and president of the Boris Corporation. He is Scott Boris. Scott, thank you so much for joining Stephen Brunt and myself on Writer's Block. We trust you're doing well. So tell us a little bit about what the, you know, well, obviously the Blue Jays will let us know at some point, but what do you think the organization's plans for Austin will be? This is an unusual year, not just because of, obviously because of the way the schedule has been interrupted by COVID-19, and we talk about that in a few minutes as well, but because the minor leagues aren't in operation. So what do you think the Jays' plans for Austin would be?
Well, in most organizations, I know with Torkelson and they took them to their 60-man camp, and they're working them out and really getting to know the player. I think that's something that Ross is probably contemplating, and you know, I think we wanted to get through the signing process and get all that completed, and then I think they're going to decide what they're going to do from there.
Was this a tough sign in any way, Scott? Was it a tough negotiation in any way? Were there any complications involved?
No, I think this was a pretty special situation for the Blue Jays in the sense it kind of reminded me of Mark Teixeira, where he was really one of the top players in the draft, and he, fell to a club that you would not normally expect to get them. But Austin is a player that in the past drafts it could have likely been the number one pick in the draft. He is a unique player because he, like Chris Bryant, is so versatile because he can play infield and outfield positions and do it with great comfort. And plus his bat has that kind of power that you would expect more from a larger player, more of a corner outfielder. And yet he's got infield size, so we call it dirt power, and it's pretty rare for a player to have dirt power. And I think the Blue Jays got themselves something pretty special here.
Scott, when the Blue Jays made this pick, and again, we talked before you came on a bit about a lot of the draft, a lot of the draft, the pre-draft conversation was he would go 2 and maybe go 3. Now, I understand that a lot of people will say, well, there's not a great deal of difference between 2 and 5, but there is a little bit of difference financially. And there's also, you know, when you've been told you're going to go a certain place or somebody is going to likely pick you in a certain spot, there is, I'm not going to say you're going to be disappointed necessarily, but I'm just wondering initially on draft day, because we haven't had a chance to talk to him, what Austin's reaction was when that second pick came and went and he was, and he was still on the board.
Well, this is something we know. We're in communication with all the clubs, mm-hmm. and it's not draft day is really not a surprise to the players so much. I think the bigger surprises are that the clubs that you know are on the same plane as the player is about his value, and they have to make decisions. And some clubs are going to go by positions because their relative need for position players versus pitching is really a dominant consideration in the draft, particularly if there's quality on both sides. So if you see an organization that you know is really lacking in pitching depth, it's unlikely that a very, very good position player would be chosen, knowing that there's a very, very good pitcher there. So with those considerations, you kind of have an indication what organizations are heavy on position players or pitching. And so it's rather predictable within a club or two, I would say.
Yeah, Scott, you've been forthright about your opinion about the direction the Toronto Blue Jays organization and ownership were taking you. It wasn't that long ago you were talking about them having the blue flu and not maybe being able to spend in accordance with the size of their market. You've concluded two pretty significant negotiations with this organization in the last few months with Ryu and now with Martin. What are your current thoughts about the direction this organization and this ownership is taking?
Well, Mark and Ross have done a really good job of building a foundational core where they literally have a middle of a lineup that includes players who can play the infield. And that, when you see that in a club, we are going to get middle lineup potential with players who can really fulfill infield spots. That is something that most clubs in baseball don't have. And it also opens the door for you to get slugging players, corner outfielders that are often more available in free agency than infielders. And I think it gives you an opportunity then to say that I can really hunt on major free agent pitching, and I know that my club is going to be both financially within a lane because I have 6-5 years of control over major middle lineup bats, so I am able to really keep a budgetary assessment of a team in line with very reason standards for a good period of time, and also get key free agent components that allow the team to be immediately competitive. So I would say right now the Blue Jays are really in an excellent position going forward here for the next 5-6 years.
In a lot of ways, Scott, it's kind of like the Chicago Cubs, what the Cubs did. Is it not sort of getting that position, young position player core? A lot of guys were middle infielders, maybe shift a guy to the outfield. And then, as you say, spend money in free agent pitching. It seems to be almost a similar, at least from a distance, a similar tack.
Well, you have to have the draft cooperate with you because mm-hmm. the talent is so rare to get power that can play in the infield. They got Bryant and they got Baez. And so when you're looking at those two players, that fits that model. And then you were also, but they also were able to trade for Rizzo. They drafted Almora as well, and got an immediate, you know, center field type player. So they've really been able to, but remember too, to win, they spent $500 million in free agency.
Correct.
Because they went out and spent on Hayward, they spent on Lester, they spent on Zobrist. They made a very serious commitment in free agency and they did a great job of trading for Addison Russell and Rizzo to complement it. So they used all three forces of baseball, trade and the draft. And free agency. But the core of that was getting those draft picks that truly had unique skill that gave you middle line of bats and played in the infield. And that's the similarity that I think Mark and Ross have really been able to attain here in the last couple of years.
Scott, the last time we had you on the show was in the middle of those contentious negotiations between the PA and the commissioner's office over the restart and the terms of the restart, the back and forth, you know, which ended obviously with going back to the March agreement and the 60 games of prorated salary, and the commissioner saying at a certain point after that they only ever intended to play 60 games, which, you know, smacked of bad faith to some people. You know, you're in contact with some pretty significant, your clients are some of the most significant players in the game, obviously. What is the mood of the players right now in terms of the restart?
Well, the players reached a good faith agreement with the March 26th agreement and literally gave up half their salaries and fully expected to play and create a roadmap for this. That would have allowed, certainly as contemplated in the agreement, playing without spectators. And, you know, we should have clearly had this accomplished by if not the middle of June, the 1st of July, and had a 100-game schedule. The shocking admission by the commissioner illustrated exactly what their plan was from the start, that they had no intentions of ever playing 100 games and giving the fans a competent season. They wanted to provide a college season, if you will, a 60-game season, because of their economic dynamic that they wanted to fulfill. And I'm a believer that there should be two bodies in baseball. One should be the judicial branch, if you will, and that is labor lawyers who are there to enforce the rules, and they're there to legislate and mandate new rules to protect the integrity of the game. But as far as when you ask labor lawyers to be business operators, when you ask them to be business operators, you get things like this. And it's something to me that really hurts the game, and I think it was unfortunate.
Are you and or your clients concerned about the kind of stumbling start to the testing program?
Well, what I'm most excited about, Jeff and Steven, is that we started this with such an amazing low percentage of players that were that tested positive in the first place. Because I think they had 1.2% included coaching staffs. And so the player community was less than 1%. So when you start off like that and you have such an amazing amount of your performance community, we only have to look to the Asian models in Korea and Taiwan and Japan to see that the operation of baseball with no fans, once everyone is tested negative, has been quite clear. There's not been one hospitalization. It's been done rather safely. And so I'm really encouraged by this early result, and that we've had so many of the players report without incident, and that the detection aspect of this that we've been able to accomplish has come early. And obviously there's going to be some hiccups here on testing as far as how you finally determine when a player is ready to return. But overall, we've had really a very, very great start in getting a huge volume of players ready to play baseball within 15 days.